Thank you. I thought we'd give you 5 extra minutes, but we'd like to start. Just wait a minute. Welcome to the start of a new Miliband lecture series this academic year on inequalities, old and new, and the impact of inequalities, old and new. I'd like to say something about the series briefly, but before I do, I'd like to welcome and introduce a person who has played more tennis, watched more live soccer games, bought and sold more cars, met with more presidents and prime ministers, written more books, and given more lectures without notes than I can remember anyone else competing with. So please join with me to welcome the ex-director of the LSE, Tony Giddens. Of course, for those of us who've known him a long time, we have to now say Professor Lord Giddens. Tonight's lecture is the first in our new Miliband series, as I've noted. The lectures planned, I think, are rather impressive, even though I say so myself. Following on this evening's lecture, we have on the 21st of October, just to give you a sense, our own John Hills, who's going to talk about inequality in the state. In early December, we have Gosting Esping Anderson, who will talk about inequality, the welfare state in Europe. Early in the new year, we have Barbara Ehrenreich and Polly Toynbee on gender inequalities, old patterns, and new challenges. In February, we have Branko Milanovic on international inequalities and international institutions. In March, we have Nancy Fraser, rethinking equality. On March the 22nd, we have Robert Reich talking about the implications of the American elections, bracket depending on who wins, close brackets. And on April the 26th, we have Ed Balls, Robert Wade, and I hope Martin Wolf debating why inequality matters, and there are more to come. All these details on the LSE website, on the Miliband part of the website, in the events, leaflets, and so on. But there's just one other lecture to mention, a hangover from the cancellation last year. On the 23rd of November, Homi Bhabha will be talking in the themes of culture and the age of global communications. He's a remarkable cultural theorist, a person that is highly cosmopolitan and yet rooted in the world, and he will give a wonderful address. But tonight we start with Anthony Giddens, the new egalitarianism, or rather egalitarianism old and new, and I would just like to say a few brief words about someone who I've known for over 30 years, who's impressed me for the 3 decades and is also a close friend. Anthony Giddens is without doubt the most widely cited contemporary sociologist in the world. He's the author and editor of well over 30 books translated into 40 plus languages. His first book, Capitalism, Modern Social Theory, is still readable 3 decades after it was published. It remains, in my view, the best account of Marx, Weber, and Durkheim written, certainly in the English-speaking world, and is still a set textbook years after it was conceived. He's also the author of numerous academic bestsellers, and his path-breaking textbook, Sociology, has sold over 1 million copies worldwide since it was published. So afterwards, I want to talk about royalties and inequality with him. Anthony Giddens is also well known for writings across a diversity of areas, apart from core subjects of sociology, social theory, the history of social thought, family, relationships, sexuality. His work spans an extraordinary range of topics, and it's an extraordinary output over a consistently long period of time. But if that is not enough, of course, he has had an impact on contemporary political thinking, the author of the well-known Third Way books, which have been bestsellers in many countries, and his advice has been sought by social democratic leaders from around the world, hence my earlier remarks, man who's known more PMs and presidents than anyone else I've known. It's an amazing record. Anthony Giddens was born in Edmonton, in North London. He was educated at Hull and the LSE. He was the first member of his family to go to college. He remains, quote, a dedicated, if frustrated, supporter of his local football team, Tottenham Hotspur. If the truth be known, he would have rather been a professional footballer, but we all here should be very glad he, in fact, became the director of the LSE. So welcome again, Anthony Giddens.
Well, thank you, David. If I ever need a PR agent, I'll know who to turn to. Let me say what a pleasure it is to be back at the LSE, and what an honor it is to be asked to give the first Miliband lecture in this series this year. I feel I must say a couple of words about Ralph Miliband because he was one of the great intellectual figures of the LSE who made a deep impact on me both personally and intellectually in the earlier part of my career. He was deservedly famous across the world for his writings on contemporary capitalism. If you ever wanted someone with charisma, he had charisma. He had passion. He was really committed intellectual. And I think, this amazing series that David's assembled this year is a very good token of the importance of his memory. I think for people here who are fairly new to the LSE, I ought to also say just a little bit about how we got the money for the Miliband lectures. Because this is a really poignant little story. You got all these, not me, but these other famous people coming in this series. All this money came from a guy called Mr. Wooliger, who lived in, it seems, a sort of seedy hotel room in Bangkok. And Mr. Wooliger was a student of Ralph Miliband's at the LSE. And through the auspices of Dorothy Johnson in the development office, we were kind of put in contact with him. And honestly, he used to write me these letters, which are like Graham Greene type things. He was sitting in his seedy hotel room and you'd get these letters all kind of mistyped on, not a computer, but an old fashioned typewriter. And he said these things that really, stayed with me ever since. He said that he didn't feel he had much longer to live and he didn't have a lot of money, but the money he did have, he wanted to leave to the LSE. And he left, I think, almost all the money he had to the LSE. He died, I think, about 3 years after this. He kept sending me up to his death these letters about the state of the world, which were also moving. But the sort of most moving thing he said, I felt, was that he didn't agree with Ralph Miliband's politics. But what he was struck by was the importance of looking at the world in a critical way. And Mr. Wooliger wrote to me and said, well, I'm not a left winger, but what I learned from Ralph was a view of the world that the world could be different, that we should be critical intellectuals. And he said something like, we should have the passion that Ralph had. So there's a very interesting little scenario behind this series of high-powered lectures. Now, what I'm going to do today is, I'm afraid, slightly parochial, because what I'm going to do is talk about inequality in the UK only. I'm going to talk about economic inequality, not other forms of inequality, because, of course, there are many forms of inequality. I'm going to talk mainly about income inequality, not primarily inequality of wealth, although that's obviously very important. And I want to pose a series of questions and try and answer them in this lecture. I think anyone who's au fait with British politics will recognize that the debate about economic inequality is one of the key dividing lines, really, between, as it were, old Labour on the one hand and the modernising left, or new Labour, if you like, on the other. Those from the more traditional left feel that whatever else new Labour has done has not done enough to limit the inequalities with which this country is afflicted, and new Labour, those from the more traditional left, say must do more. Woody Allen, that great sage of contemporary culture, said money is better than poverty if only for financial reasons. And Marshall McLuhan, who was a sort of celebrated theorist of media, once said money is the poor man's credit card. Something worth pondering, because there is something in that statement. Somebody else said you should always live within your means, even if you have to borrow to do so. Well, tell that to the President of the United States, for the United States has a debt of $7 trillion at this moment. I want to ask the question, therefore, what does New Labour's record on attacking inequality look like? Should we be doing more? And if so, what more should we be doing? I think an appropriate starting point for this is to look at a strategic audit of the UK, which the strategy unit, which is attached to number 10 Downing Street, carried out and published, put on its website anyway, in about 2003. And this strategic audit was a kind of audit of the position of the UK compared to other industrial countries in the world, and it produced sort of very interesting results, I think. What it showed was that the UK is doing pretty well. If you look at the economy, it's pretty strong. Rates of unemployment are low. You might not believe this, but if you look at surveys of life satisfaction, the UK came fourth out of 15 EU countries in terms of expressed levels of life satisfaction. If you look at the ecological record of the UK, it's actually pretty good compared to most other EU countries. But there is one area where the performance of Britain as a society stands out, where it does very poorly. Stands out like a sore thumb, really, in this audit, and that area is inequality. I had the, you know, there's a guy called Max Storer, I don't know if he's here in the audience, but he was always telling me I'm not enough of a scientific sociologist, so I had all these snazzy little tables to bring you that I was going to put on here, but there was a mix-up and I left them at home, so I'm just going to have to describe to you what these tables show. They're actually quite impressive, so it's a shame that they didn't arrive here. Child poverty. One was on child poverty. UK, especially when New Labour came into power, performed very, very poorly in terms of levels of child poverty. The rate of child poverty in the UK placed it 14th out of 15th in EU countries, among the 15 EU countries at that time, anyway. You look at other methods of poverty, such as recurrent poverty, multiple deprivation, the UK again does pretty poorly compared to not only its EU partners, but also to most other OECD industrial countries too. Finally, I had some good stuff on overall economic inequality, which would have dazzled you with its scientific rigor, but what this showed is that UK doesn't do very well either in terms of overall levels of economic inequality, especially if you look at the period in the 80s and 90s when New Labour was first of all in power. Finally, in my snazzy non-existent charts, I had this one that gives some interesting findings about the earnings of the top 1% and the top 0.05% of income earners. And what this graph shows is that in the UK, over the past 15 to 20 years, the top 1% and the top 0.05% have pulled away from the rest of the population. They are doing very, very well compared to the majority of the population. The top earners are doing very well over the past few years. Not only that, but this chart was going to show, did show and does show, where it reposes somewhere in my house, that this is not true of all EU countries. It's true of the United States. You find the same kind of sharp movement away among top income earners in the United States as you find in the UK, even more extreme than in the UK. But among other EU countries like France or Germany or the Scandinavian countries, there isn't much of a pull away among the top 1%. So there is something distinctive about the British pattern of inequality here. Now, when New Labour got into power, they, in 1997, they took self-consciously a different approach from the old left. I think New Labour self-consciously restructured their policies away from some of the main premises of traditional leftism. Let me give you four main points outlining Labour's policies relevant to the restructuring which lay behind the policies they introduced to try to cope with inequality and poverty in the country. First of all, unlike their predecessors, And this is, I think, probably more from the impact of Gordon Brown than from Tony Blair, although, as I said in a lecture at the LSE the other day, you have to see them as twins. They're like Lennon and McCartney. They're not going to prosper, really, without one another. So New Labour is a kind of joint creation. But the first emphasis, very important one, driven, I think, more by the Treasury than by number 10, if you want to put that away, is that economic policy is the key to social policy. That unless you have a stable economy, unless you have decent growth rates, you can't do much either about public services or about the inequalities to which the society is subject. Old Labour, as it were, you could put it this way, were strong on inequality. That is, were always saying they wanted to reduce inequalities, but were not strong on economic dynamism, were not strong on job creation, on what you need to do to create a competitive economy in the modern world. Thatcherism was the other way around, was pretty strong on competitiveness, on making the economy more competitive, and indeed the British economy did become more competitive during the Thatcherite period, albeit at considerable cost to the wider society, but it did become more competitive. The point of New Labour, however, and the Brownite view, and also my view, is to connect economic dynamism, solidarity, the attack on inequality, and investment in public services. So you want to look for policies wherever possible which do both, which promote job creation, which promote economic dynamism, which make the economy competitive, but at the same time help us reduce inequalities. It's one of the main reasons why tax credits figure so strongly in the Chancellor's programme for combating inequality, because tax credits help you to get people into work. At the same time, therefore, they help to some extent create jobs. They promote involvement in the economy, but they also reduce inequalities. Tax credits have other advantages, of course. That is, you don't really see them, and people don't really perceive them as traditional benefits, as kind of handouts. So they're politically more palatable than traditional benefits are. But the first emphasis, very important emphasis of New Labour, which I'll argue later in this lecture must be sustained, is that you must have a strong economy, and it must be a stable economy, if you're going to do much effectively about inequality or investment in public services. Second, New Labour, to some extent anyway, not completely of course, in contrast to Old Labour, put a lot of emphasis upon equality of opportunity rather than equality of outcome. New Labour wants to expand opportunities, especially for people near the bottom of the society, and sees this as crucial to the first point, because if you're going to have a dynamic economy, you must have aspirational society. You must have people who are prepared to be dynamic themselves, who want to get on, who want to make something of their lives. So this emphasis is a quite important one, and Gordon Brown called it, and still calls it, the importance of human potential. We want a society which allows people to live up to the potential which they have, especially people at the bottom who are frustrated by it being cut off, as it were, from the wider society. However, as I would see it, this was never a pure meritocratic model. You can't have increasing equality of opportunity without a strong measure of equality of outcome. It's very, very obvious, because if you didn't have that, one generation's equality of opportunity would be the next generation's denial of that opportunity, because you'd have a kind of rich caste which then passed on the wealth to the next generation. So you must have a measure of equality of outcome, redistribution, if you like, going along with equality of opportunity. Third emphasis, well, the core of Labour's programme, really, Labour introduced a whole barrage, New Labour, a whole barrage of policies aimed at the poor. And they did so with a different political philosophy from Old Labour, because I think Old Labour, at least to some degree, was interested in reducing the gap between the top and the bottom, the very top and the very bottom. New Labour decided not to try to do that. New Labour thought it's more important to reduce the gap between the middle and the bottom, because there are far more people there. Therefore, we should target policy primarily at the poor, try to improve their life circumstances, so you get a shifting balance between those at the bottom and those who are more affluent above them. And the range of policies which New Labour introduced is pretty formidable. I'll just read some of them out to you. The childcare tax credit, working tax credit, pension credit, minimum wage, much resisted from the right at the time, you might remember, and the New Deal to get young people into work. Sure Start for children and the child tax credit, and a whole maze of programs, apparently about 71 programs, devoted to deprived areas. So it's not true to say Labour have not been trying to do something about inequality. They absolutely have, certainly at the bottom of the class structure. The flagship of New Labour's programs is their commitment to the eradication of child poverty. People say New Labour has not been bold, but this is surely one area where they have been. Because Tony Blair gave a commitment about 3 years ago, a speech I remember attending somewhere on the other side of the river, in which he said, we will abolish child poverty by the year 2020. So commitment not only to reduce child poverty, but to abolish child poverty over not really too long a period, or who knows whether they'll be in power over that whole period. Fourthly, finally, New Labour weren't like old Labour because they took a more relaxed attitude to people at the top, the big earners. New Labour basically decided to leave the top alone because of the logic of the position I just described, more important to shift resources around where there are more resources, from the upper middle to the bottom than from the very top to the bottom. And Tony Blair once said, when he was asked about this, what are you going to do about bloody rich Tony? He said something like, it's not my business to make sure that David Beckham earns less. And what he meant by that is that New Labour should be unlike old Labour in the sense of believing that everyone is wealthy, has got their wealth through noxious means, because people get their wealth through things that are valuable to society often. By no means all of them, it has to be said, but many of them certainly do. And what New Labour decided to do was not increase income tax rates for those at the top. That was a controversial policy in 1997, and it remains a controversial policy today. So this was a pretty substantial programme, and let me move on to the second part of the lecture and just assess what the impact of this programme has been. I would stress out the first 4 points. It's not true that New Labour was unconcerned with social justice. Been very, very strongly concerned with social justice. Not true that New Labour, is uninterested in wider patterns of inequality. Had more programmes, really, oriented towards reducing these things, probably, than certainly most previous Labour governments, but a different philosophy underlying it. A philosophy, if you like, of political realism, I would describe it. Let's do what we can do, rather than pie-in-the-sky schemes. Now, it took quite a long while before we could assess the impact of these policies. And early on, after 1997, New Labour was kind of criticised very strongly from the left for people who said, well, look, inequality hasn't changed very much. Not much difference visible. But there wouldn't be much difference visible. You don't change things in 2 or 3 years. Now it's been 7 years, and we have a much better understanding of what these policies amount to in terms of their consequences for inequality. Here I've got 5 points to make quickly about what these policies have produced. First of all, Gordon Brown's emphasis upon keeping labour markets flexible above the level of a minimum wage, much criticised from some circles on the left, has proved its value. It was right of Brown to claim, I think, that having a dynamic economy is crucial to generating social justice. It's proved its value, especially in terms of employment. Levels of unemployment in the UK are currently very low. It's always been an historic ambition of the left to produce full employment. Well, at the moment, there is effectively full employment in this economy. But not only that, perhaps even more importantly, the level of job creation in the British economy is very, very high. Not all attributed to New Labour, of course, but nevertheless, if you look at the Lisbon Agenda for the EU, the Lisbon Agenda was a kind of scheme for where the EU should stand in the year 2015. Well, according to the Lisbon Agenda, by 2015, no one thinks it's going to happen, really, and the EU countries should have 70% of people in work. Well, the UK already has 75% of the available labour force in work, so its employment record is very, very good. And employment is a form of social justice. Unemployment is a masked form, often, of inequality. Well, not so masked. It's also important to recognise that work has been a major route out of poverty, and that the labour stress on work as a means of moving out of poverty has been, I think, amply justified. Although it has its problems, which I'll come to later. Second, New Labour placed an emphasis, not like Old Labour did, on tax rates, but on the tax take, the total amount of money you have available to spend to help people. And this emphasis has also proved to be justified. There's no point squabbling too much about formal rates of income tax. What's important, well, that is important, but in addition, you need to generate the resources which will allow you to fund your spending programs. Under New Labour, depending on how you calculate it, the proportion of taxation in relation to GDP has risen. It hasn't risen apart from national insurance by putting up rates. It's risen more by having a successful economy, generating the resources which can be fed into public institutions. Depending on how you calculate it, something like just over 40% of GDP in the UK now comes from taxation, up about 2 or 3 points from what it was previously, so there are more resources to go around. Thirdly, there have been significant reductions in child poverty, in overall levels of poverty, and in poverty among the over 65s. If you use the EU criterion of poverty being those who live under 60% of median income, most people now agree that the numbers of the poor have fallen by about 1.5 million from 1997 to 2002 to 2003. And most people also agree that Labour is on target to reach its goal of reducing child poverty by a quarter by the end of the financial year 2005. Quite significant inroads made there. Fourthly, as measured at least after housing costs, poverty among older people, the over 65s, fell by over 1 million up to the year 2003 to 2004. Older people are actually doing pretty well because a lot of the balance of inequality in our society has shifted downwards towards children and towards small families. But nevertheless, New Labour's policies have made a significant difference and could make an even bigger difference if they get it right to the economic situation of older people. Finally, there has been redistribution. If you look at the lowest 10% of income earners, they're about 8% better off. Well, they were about 8% better off in real terms in 2003 than they were in 1997. There has been at least a certain measure of redistribution from the kinds of areas which New Labour sought to achieve it. Moreover, there's another quite significant thing, I think, which is the following. If you look at overall levels of economic inequality, many people say overall economic inequality has not changed under Labour, it simply continued to increase. This does not seem to be the case, according to most recent statistics. If you look at the findings of the IFS, Institute of Fiscal Studies, they show that overall economic inequality, the Gini coefficient in the UK, has leveled off, has stabilized over the past 2 or 3 years. And the IFS argue that this leveling off of inequality is the result of Labour's policies. Labour's policies have not actually brought down the graph of overall economic inequality, but they have caused it to level off. Therefore, they have made a significant contribution to at least a stabilisation of overall economic inequality. Now these, I think, I don't know whether you agree, but to me these things are real achievements. They are substantial achievements. I think you could even say that this Labour government is the first government, Labour government, really, to actually affect redistribution rather than just talk about it. I mean, I think many people on the more traditional left look back to a time when Labour leaders spoke more openly about equality. But as Paul Thompson observed, this masks the fact that they did bugger all about it. It's one thing to talk about it, it's another to achieve it. And however modest, New Labour has achieved a measure of redistribution. This has been not been true of previous Labour governments. Why? Because you come back to the economic criterion. Almost all previous Labour governments have founded an economic crisis about 4 or 5 years into office. Therefore, for all their bold promises of redistribution, of having a more equal society, that has not been the outcome of at least most prior periods of Labour government. But is it enough? The IPPR, which is a research organisation just down the road across the other side of the Kingsway from here, recently produced a study on the state of the nation, in which they looked at social justice in the UK. It's a very good document if anybody is interested in these issues. And what the document showed was, first of all, they agreed that New Labour has made significant contributions, especially to reducing certain categories of poverty as a result of the policies that I've just described. But they argue that many people think that New Labour's programme still lacks impetus, still lacks drive, still lacks vision. There's not enough being done, given the vast range of inequalities, which is still true, this society is subject. What they don't do in the IPPR report, however, is to say how you should, they don't do the hard bit, they don't say how you should tackle these issues. Now, I would like to say, and this leads me to the sort of second chunk of the lecture, that their view is correct. We do need New Labour to make a new move to egalitarianism. I feel the Labour government at this point should make a commitment to a renewed egalitarianism. And I think there's something kind of out of kilter, really, with New Labour's perspective, because New Labour have given so much commitment to renewal of public services. And I think there will indeed be a renewal of public services. The money that's gone in must and will bear results over the next few years. But there's been no parallel integrated commitment, really, to securing a more socially just society. However, to secure a more socially just society, for me anyway, it won't do to go back to the nostrums of the old left. It won't do to sort of push what I would call old left populism, which what I would describe as hike up taxes substantially again, intervene in labour markets to re-regulate them, and invest in public services without bothering to try to reform. Maybe a caricature, but it's a sort of perspective which some people have. I don't think such a perspective would be feasible. You couldn't produce a substantial increase in tax at this point and hope to survive electorally. If you made labour markets more rigid again, rates of unemployment would rise. And if you were invested in public services without doing the difficult bit, that is contesting those who would resist reforms which will make public services more effective, well then people's money will have been wasted. So let's have a renewed egalitarianism, but for me it has to be what I would call a new egalitarianism. Not just a, hence the title of this lecture, not just a kind of pro forma repetition of the critique of the old left of New Labour. You have to have a new egalitarianism for two main reasons. One is that you must sustain the Gordon Brown emphasis, I think, upon the importance of economic policy as crucial to what you do with regard to social justice. The second is that you must respond to the big changes transforming our society. New Labour, I put it to you, audience, is a third way party, but the third way was never an empty PR device. The third way was never a middle way. The third way was never succumbing to markets. What it is an attempt to update, to upgrade left to centre political thinking so as to relate to the massive changes transforming our society. The impact of global economic competition, the emergence of a service economy. Well, over 80% of the labour force now works in services. It's a fantastic transformation, really, of the economy. And the rise of individualism, which has sort of transformed people's attitudes towards politics and many other aspects of their lives. So a new egalitarianism can't be just a rerun of the old egalitarianism. And there's no point pretending that it isn't difficult. It is difficult. It's difficult to find a set of policies which will be electorally feasible, which will be realistic, which won't be just pie in the sky policies, but which will do something further beyond what's been achieved in reducing economic inequality. Now, I'd like to say what my version of this would be, and go back to four main points, which I believe are worth exploring. But I would stress that I have as many questions as answers, and I'm not sure that anyone has completely satisfactory answers to how you push a program of attacking inequality substantially further. My main 4 points then are the following. First of all, New Labour's problems with articulating a vision of social justice which would go along with their vision of renewed public services surely in some part comes from the scattergun nature of their policies. New Labour had all this, or has all this vast range of policies to tackle inequality and poverty that I mentioned. But it has so many policies, it's very hard for anyone to make sense of them. Even if, like, you know, you've got the famous Professor Ann Power sitting in this room, it would take her a whole academic life, really, to study what the impact of these policies have been. So diverse are they. It's not surprising that the public doesn't see the Labour Party as a party substantially committed to social justice, because it's so difficult to put these different kinds of policies together and see an integrated dynamic behind them. Well, New Labour should do this. New Labour should put all these things together. I don't think it's at all impossible. So simplify, coordinate, integrate, show a commitment, not just have a kind of scattergun of pellets all over the place that the public can't make sense of and even social policy experts struggle with. Second, I think a more spelled out vision of an egalitarian society would help reduce the scattergun nature of Labour's policies. And I've been particularly influenced by a version presented by a German political scientist who works with the SPD, the German Social Democratic Party, political scientist called Wolfgang Merkel, M-E-R-K-E-L, who has set out, you know, German Social Democratic Party is going through all the same kind of difficulties of modernization as all left of center parties are. Merkel has set out a sort of basic scheme for what a movement towards social justice could look like under the postmodern social conditions, which I mentioned earlier. Let me just quickly run through it. He has, you know, going in fours and fives, he has five elements in his ideological framework of social justice. An egalitarian outlook should involve the following five things. First, the fight against poverty, not because of economic inequality in itself, but because poverty, above all enduring poverty, limits the individual's capacity for autonomy and self-esteem. It's not poverty as such, it's what poverty does to your life that needs to be contested. Second, We should build the highest possible standards for education and training, rooted in fair and open access even for those at the bottom of the society. In other words, open opportunity principle that I described earlier. Third, we should ensure employment for all those willing and able, which Labour is not far from having achieved, as I mentioned. Fourthly, we should have a welfare state which ensures protection and dignity. I think the dignity part is a crucial part of this, because welfare states do not have a good record for treating their clients well. Welfare states often demean those who have to rely upon them. And fifthly, limitation of inequality of income and wealth if they hinder the first four goals or endanger the cohesion of society. This framework seems to me pretty good ideological framework for a new egalitarianism, because it's simple, it's direct, it conforms to the need to create a socially just society within a dynamic economy which stresses individual aspiration and opportunity. And rather crucially, it shows why child poverty is so important, why attacking child poverty is so important. When New Labour made its promise to eradicate child poverty, it kind of stood apart from the other policies New Labour had. People said, why are they radical on this and not on other things? But I think if you look at Merkel's five criteria, you can see why you need to be radical on child poverty, because child poverty affects all five. It's the only form of poverty which affects all five of the criteria which Merkel mentions. So I think we have a pretty decent framework there, which has the virtue of being luminous and down to earth and not philosophically pretentious. Thirdly, New Labour and all of us interested in combating inequality has got a lot of thinking to do about the limits of the policies which it has in place. I'm not pretending to answer these questions, although happy to discuss any of them in whatever discussion we have afterwards. We don't really know, for example, how we're going to halve child poverty by 2010, which is the next phase on the way to eradicating child poverty. How are we going to do this? Well, the existing, mostly it's been done by tax credits, but have we come to the end of the role which tax credits can assume, because they're very complicated for people to understand? A lot of people don't take up what they offer, for example. There was a review by the Child Poverty Review in 2003 which looked at the issue of how you get towards reducing child poverty by half in 10 years, and it was a bit kind of New Labourish, because it came up with another flurry of initiatives, some 18 initiatives in all, adding to the, you know, the vast scattergun of policies which existed previously. What do we do about those who can't work? Because New Labour's policies primarily oriented towards getting people in the labour market. They have been successful, I mentioned, but not everybody can work and therefore will be left outside. Should we be reducing taxes for poorer groups? I think actually that we should. Taxation is of course central to attacking inequality, but you don't necessarily have to look to the top, although as I say in a minute, we should look to the top. You can also look to the bottom. One of the things about New Labour which I think is quite important is that they no longer regarded taxation simply in terms of the amount of money raised, but also see that fiscal devices influence behaviour. Tax credits, for example, influence behaviour. They can get you, motivate you to get a job. It's a much more sophisticated view of taxation, I think, than the old left tended to have. It's going to be difficult, I think, to raise overall levels of taxation except in the way in which New Labour have done it, which, as I mentioned earlier, is partly through actually taking initiative and raising rates of national insurance, but also through leaving tax rates stable. So as people get more affluent, as the economy expands, they naturally pay more in taxation without resenting it so much. So we should look for taxation, continue to look for fiscal devices which will help those at the bottom, and which will, in some part anyway, redistribute through those fiscal devices. But I think we do need a new package. I don't think the existing package of policies that New Labour has is sufficient to drive us on to a next stage. Because you're going to get to the more difficult inequalities. In the IPPR report, they say what Labour has done is pluck the low-hanging fruit. You know, they've got the people who are easiest to get into work, as it were, into work. They've dealt with some of the easiest issues. But when you look at some of the most deprived areas in the country where poverty is so deeply embedded, how are we going to reverse those? How are we going to reverse those pockets of, as it were, ultimate deprivation? How are we going to push on to the next phase? These policies, I think, again, need to be integrated and deepened. Finally, concluding part of what I have to say, ticklish issue, what do we do about the people at the top? I tried to portray it. New Labour's philosophy actually makes quite a lot of sense, which is don't bother too much about people at the very top, because they're only a tiny minority anyway. You're never going to get much money from them anyway. Therefore, you have to redistribute within the bulk of income earners rather than fretting about the sort of 1% or 0.05% of people at the top, who, whatever they do, is not going to really influence the rest of the system very much. There is a certain logic to that, and it even has a philosophical position in American political philosophy. It's called, I think, sufficientarianism, that you should concentrate on the bottom and not really worry about the long distance gap between the very poorest and the richest. So there is a kind of logic to Labour's position, but I don't think it's satisfactory. I don't think you can build a fairer society without looking at the top as well as at the bottom. But here you face the difficulty, I think, because to me, one, New Labour should be still New Labour on this issue. That is, you do want to recognise the success which can breed economic success, can often be not only valuable but necessary to the wider society. You do need entrepreneurs who create jobs, for example, who might themselves become wealthy in the process, but who drive the overall economy along. You don't want, I think, simply to have a society in which success is resented, in which a kind of old leftish view that everyone who makes money is somehow inevitably tainted by the process or has only got wealthy because of exploiting others, because this is by no means always true. So I think one must be fairly New Labourish on these issues. But I think we have to start thinking about two sets of groups, really. One, if you like, are the very rich, the top 1% pulling away. It can't be healthy for a society if the top 1% is pulling away like that from the rest, I don't think. And second, we have to think about the top 10%, that is a sort of wider number of affluent people, and what policies we should have in place in relation to them. As regards the top 1%, the key issue is, should we be raising income tax, for example, on those earning over 100,000 a year, which is the policy of the Liberal Democrats? Myself, I don't think so, but we can certainly debate it if anyone is interested, for various reasons. One is, I don't think that that policy will bring in the amount of money which the Liberal Democrats claim. They claim 5 million. I think, having looked at it in as much detail as an amateur can, seems to me it'll bring about 3.5 billion pounds a year. 3.5 billion is not very much at all in the overall scope of things. It would also provide the Tories with an avenue of attack. Labour, again, tax raising party. So I think my view anyway for the moment is it's not really worth doing, and we should be looking elsewhere. Where should we be looking? Well, we should be looking, I think, in relation to kind of integrated view of egalitarianism, at the citizenship responsibilities of the top 1% and the top 0.5%. Why do we only consider social exclusion at the bottom? Why don't we consider social exclusion at the top? Social exclusion at the top is the irresponsible behaviour of certain categories anyway, of highly affluent people who profit from the wider society but deny that they do so, whose profits depend upon adequate public services, for example, but who deny that, who are prepared to enrich themselves without recognising the citizenship responsibilities of corporations. So to me, it's probably going to be much more effective to try to, for example, limit aggressive tax avoidance schemes and limit tax evasion, and do so, if possible, in a positive way to encourage greater citizenship among the more affluent, than it is simply to raise obsessionally income tax rates at the top. Legal tax avoidance schemes currently cost the country about 3 or 4 times what would be gained through putting up a tax on those who earn over $100,000 a year. We should be looking, I think, for a series of measures which take further the innovations which Patricia Hewitt has introduced to try to enhance shareholder power, to try to get greater responsibility into corporate salaries, to have a more adequate framework of citizenship, if you like, for business. Business kind of broke away from its citizenship obligations, and we should be looking for ways to reintegrate them in the wider society. These could be positive, not negative. Why not have tax credits for the rich as well as for the poor, for example? Tax credits which would reward contribution, philanthropy, for example. These things, it seems to me, are important, and it's important that the Treasury is currently trying to cut down, fairly effectively so far, on both legal tax avoidance, aggressive tax avoidance, and tax evasion. Finally, what about the top 10%? Well, there's not much time to talk about them, but they're a very sort of crucial group, and I think what New Labour should be doing here is they must kind of gulp and at least take a look at the intersection between the private and public spheres in our society. Because I think inequalities in the UK somehow balance around a kind of a mistaken egalitarianism of public services, where it's pretended that everyone is equal in health and education, where it's paid for by the state, but everybody knows that people are not equal, that there are massive inequalities. And then a separate private sector in health and education, where a few percent of the top 10% opt out altogether, both in health and in education. It's not like that in more egalitarian countries, interestingly. Scandinavian countries are the most egalitarian countries in the world. What do? Well, they integrate the public and private sectors much more, both in medicine and in education. And this allows the upper middle class in, because they get financial incentives to use the state system, and that's surely sensible. In the case of education, New Labour philosophy has a lot going for it, which is to shift up the state system, to make state schools better, to have specialist academies, for example, which will rival the private schools. But will they rival the private schools, or as the English perversely call them, the public schools? Well, I think the answer is it's going to be difficult, because the private schools will find means of keeping ahead. Therefore, I think we have to grasp the letter and at least look at the issue of the role of private schools in our society and the contributions they make to the wider social system. It's not at all easy. But I think Labour should at least be thinking about the sorts of schemes that are presented by the philanthropist Peter Lample, who actually gave quite a lot of money to the LSE for Saturday schemes and weekend schemes and Sunday schools from kids from poorer schools to explore what it's like to be in university. Peter Lample made an investment in a private school in Liverpool called the Belvedere School. It's a private school. And what he did was to introduce what's called needs-blind admission in that school. Needs-blind admission is what universities like Harvard, affluent universities in the US, do. You apply to Harvard and you're assessed purely in terms of your academic ability. You're guaranteed a place no matter how rich or poor you are. And if you are poor, then the university will pay for you. And what Peter Lample did is to do the same thing in the Belvedere School in Liverpool. Kids apply, they say nothing about their social background, they're assessed on their intellectual capabilities, and those who can't pay, they are paid for by Peter Lample's investment. And it produced a massive change in the social composition of the Belvedere School, because the private schools are not meritocratic, but this school became much more meritocratic, much more open to opportunity in the sense in which I described it. I think today about 70% of the students in the Belvedere School come from the bottom three social classes, and it was only about 30% before the scheme was introduced. What Peter Lample is asking is for a debate about this and for consideration that the government might provide dual investment to expand the scheme to a few other schools. Government doesn't like it because it feels it might drain the brightest schools away from the state system and therefore end up reproducing inequalities even more than the ones that exist in present. But to me, this is the kind of experimental thinking which we need if we're going to do something to produce a fairer society in a way which is compatible with the emphases that I've mentioned. So I would say New Labour needs a dual philosophy, not a single philosophy. It's not enough just to invest in public services. Let's have a renewed commitment to egalitarianism. Let's have a commitment to producing a fairer society which will go along with a society which provides more effectively for the public goods which we all need. And I would say, New Labour, go for it. Thank you.
We have half an hour for questions. Before we take questions in clusters of five, if you need to go now, please go. We understand that, but then if you're staying, stay.
If you want to stay, please stay. It's the other side of the equation, really. He put it the wrong way. He should say, please stay, but if you must go, well.
Okay, are you really nearly ready? Since the movement has stopped down below, let's take questions starting here. Roman mics, where are you? Okay, questions. Please. Tony, we'll take questions in fives, okay?
Well, if there are five people asking
there
questions. There's one down here anyway.
Yeah, one question.
That's a start.
To what extent do you think the government can effectively tackle inequality without taking the public with it in the sense that it has done? It seems to me that it's done what it has done almost by stealth, and it seems to be a deliberate decision not to crow about its achievements, and you've highlighted the achievements and they are significant. It just seems to me that when Thatcher transformed society in the 80s, she actually had a dual approach. She implemented the policies, tax cuts, privatisation, sale of council houses. She walked the walk, but she also talked the talk. I mean, she, you know, her famous declaration that society no longer exists and things like that. So all that kind of that dual combination of policy and rhetoric changed public culture, changed the political culture. What Labour's doing, it seems to me that it's walking the walk, but it's not talking the talk, and the public isn't being taken with it.
Okay, down below, yes, Robert. Go.
Tony, you have emphasized the welfare state, the delivery of public services like health and education. When you've talked about egalitarianism, these are the kinds of subjects that you've mostly concentrated on. You mentioned in passing the need to underpin this with a competitive economy, an economy with a relatively high rate of productivity growth, with research and development, and so on. But it seems to me, both from tonight and from your other writing, that you tread very lightly on that second face of the state, so to speak. Most of your attention is on the first. But the question is, have you considered, more than you indicated tonight with these passing references to the labor market, to corporate governance, have you considered ways by which third way principles might suggest new ideas for this sort of productivity generating industrial policy type role of the state?
Tony, you talked towards the end about ways of increasing the tax take at the top through reductions in avoidance and evasion. One of the particular difficulties in extracting money from the very top is the existence around the world of quite a large number of tax havens, many of which are British dependencies. And I wonder whether doing something about that would be part of your agenda for this determined assault on avoidance and sometimes evasion.
We'll complete a sweep of questions from below and then come upstairs in just a moment. Is the gentleman back?
Lord Giddens, you talked about education briefly. I'd like to know what's your position about further education, education at university, and how this might new Labour's policies might impact egalitarianism in further education.
As opposed to higher education in general.
Okay, one more downstairs. Yeah, please. Do we have a mic here? Thank you. Here.
To follow up from the previous question, there was an article in the Times yesterday where Oxford threatened to go private within a few years because of excessive government interference in its admissions policies.
Could you speak up a bit?
Oxford threatened to go private within a few years because of excessive government interference in its admissions policies. What do you think of Labour's social inclusion target at university?
Get it? It's been said yesterday and reported from Oxford that Oxford is thinking
David,
of going.
Can you tell the rest of us?
Yeah, it's been reported yesterday that key figures in Oxford are thinking of making the university private as a result of growing interference by government policy, particularly on the issues of adjusting the inclusion policies in the university and the selection policies. Okay, now we can give you, because we're going upstairs next, just 3 or 4 minutes, Tony. Can you manage? Five minutes.
No. I've got to try and answer them without sort of babbling on too long. But I think it's a very good observation, the first question, really, because I think, Labour was unable to confront, really, the issue of social justice head on, wasn't able to make a declared political philosophy of it, wasn't able to make the kind of impact that Mrs. Thatcher made when she declared her political philosophy. What does New Labour stand for? Well, one of the main things it stands for me, is making this country more social democratic, moving it away from being a Thatcherite country, contrary to what many people say. That, to me, is the goal of New Labour. Well, you do that by investing in public institutions, but you also do it by making it a more egalitarian society. So that's why I think you need a more open commitment to that. But within the framework which I mentioned, and the difficulty is reconciling all the various strands that I mentioned, because I think policies will only be effective if those are reconciled. But yes, I would be looking for a more open commitment, which would say this is the kind of society we want to achieve. It's compatible with the things that, aspiration and so forth, and however it is a different society from the one we inherited. Of course, New Labour says that, but you need better articulation of it, I think. So I would agree with that, really. Robert's question about competitive economy and productivity, I don't know whether you meant that in relation to inequality particularly, because there is a kind of relationship, I think, when you compare, say, Germany and the UK, where Germany has higher productivity, but through investment in technology and seems to have a higher number of people outside of the labour force, and that's one kind of version. The UK has more people in kind of low-level jobs, has a sort of problem with productivity, which even Gordon Brown, with all his magisterial policies, seems unable to make a big dent in, and productivity remains a key problem for the British economy. I think, Labour are proposing to increase the minimum wage, and I think they should do so, because I don't think we're looking for an American-style productivity kind of setup. We're looking for something closer to the best continental examples, but trying to reconcile that with decent levels of job creation. But I don't know of the magical key, and I don't know of any economist who does. You have the traditional nostrums of more investment in technology and that sort of thing.
no doubt that will contribute, but beyond that, I don't think anyone, unless you do, you know, has a sort of magical solution to that issue, which is an important one for this society to resolve. I'm not sure if that was the question you were asking, but that's how I interpreted it. I mean, John is the next lecturer in this series, so you've all got to come and hear him. He's written this extraordinary book about inequality, which is, when is it coming out? Pretty soon, I think.
what a coincidence.
What a surprise. Yeah, I think it's not just a question of international flow of money, I think. I think the Treasury, if you look at the finance bill, are going to make significant contributions through tightening up of, they've already done, of illegal tax avoidance schemes. And should, as I say, probably save more than they'd get by putting up top rate of income tax if it all works as they claim it will work in the finance bill. I think, you know, therefore national policy can make a lot of difference. And that's only tax avoidance, not tax evasion. Tax evasion you could probably do more about. But surely it's like David's social democratic black hole in the world economy, the sort of movement of money around the world and the escape of taxation. I mean, the OECD had this program to transform tax havens, which I strongly supported, but which the Bush administration sort of basically has, you know, blocked. And I think surely if you're going to have something like David wants global social democratic society, which will also feed into national social democracy, that program has to be realized. And I don't see it's impossible, because I think OECD came up with what looked to be a fairly practicable scheme about that. Can I take the last two questions together, because they're about higher education? When I was director of LSE, I had quite a lot of run-ins with the student body because I supported the government's policy on introducing fees for UK undergraduates, and I regard that as more compatible with social justice than the system which existed previously. The reason being, in the LSE, you have overseas students who are heavily subsidising the UK-based students beyond a level which is socially just. And second, the old system did not serve the interests of poorer students. Only 11% of students from social class 5, the bottom social class, get into university. You can't say the old system worked. It's fair that those who benefit from higher education should contribute to the overall social cost of it, in my opinion, and a substantial proportion of that money should be spent on helping those from poorer backgrounds, not just to get to university through scholarships, but also through making them aware of the possibility of going to university. As to whether, you know, all this stuff about Oxford privatization and so on, I mean, to me, in England anyway, the only two universities, well, maybe three, that could privatize are Oxford, Cambridge, and Imperial. Oxford and Cambridge have pretty substantial endowments, and they could start charging higher fees, and it's possible they could privatize down the line. I'm not sure if it's particularly a bad thing, because, you know, lots of countries have private as well as public universities. But my feeling for the LSE was that I wanted the LSE to remain substantially a public institution. I don't think even if I wanted to, there wouldn't be any way of privatizing the LSE short of someone giving it massive amounts of money beyond which a government would ever consider, I think, giving. So to me, the LSE is partly a private institution already because it depends so much on overseas student fees, but it's a privately funded public institution. And I think, you know, this is characteristic of a lot of public institutions now. There's so much demand for health, education, and so forth. Only 7% of students went to university 40 years ago. So much demand that you can't fund it solely through the state. Therefore, you must have a mixed system. But because you have private money in there, it doesn't follow that you can't follow a public purpose. And to me, that's what the LSE does. So while I was here, I certainly wasn't in favor of any scheme of privatizing the LSE, or I think the director before me did entertain such ambitions, actually.
Okay, thank you. Five questions from the top. Yeah, please. Could take the mic to the middle. And then we'll come over there.
Yeah. You talked briefly about preventing a rich class forming, yet you said nothing about inheritance tax, and that seems to go to the core of that. And you also said nothing about Brown's plans for a baby bond, which would seem to do more to... Sorry, is that working?
The second
point. I'll ask everyone to speak up.
The second point. We didn't get the second point.
And you said nothing about Brown's plans for baby bonds, which would seem to do some more to increase equality than many other policies you mentioned.
Michael.
Professor Giddens, You defined as one of...
You'll have to speak up.
Yes. You defined as one of the major elements of the new Labour philosophy the strategic decision to leave the top earners alone and not increase the income tax. We heard quite a few arguments in favor of this strategic decision, and I was wondering how costly in electoral terms, as you said, would it be to increase the income tax for the top 5% of the population, since we are only talking about the 5% of the electoral body. And a very brief second point. You also said that, and I quote, £3.5 billion is not a lot of money. Now, I'm perfectly aware that your amazing books sell quite a lot, but would you care to elaborate on this?
Okay. There was a question over here. Thank you. And yeah. One mic there and one mic over there, please.
Thanks. I just wanted to elaborate on the previous comment about inheritance tax. You said about equality of opportunity rather than equality of outcome, and yet over the generations, a straightforward race becomes more like a relay race. The problem, of course, with inheritance tax is that at any level of social class, almost everybody, without exception, wants to leave their children in a better circumstance than they started off themselves. That's a very difficult conundrum to address, and I wonder if you'd do that. Thank you.
Please.
Yes.
Keep it brief now, yeah?
Yes. I want to ask about the... You said, you know, the Brown labor policy has been that economic policy will eventually create better social justice. Now, it's predicated upon the neoclassical economics model that I know there will be growth, perpetual growth. So what happens if it's a Japan-like situation, you have no growth for 10 years, even maybe you have negative growth for 10 years? Thank you.
Just a question on related to regional disparities. I was wondering if, or get your thoughts on whether devolution or the decentralization of power contributes to inequalities, considering the differences in capacities and efficiency levels of local governments. Thank you.
Just we'll slip in one more. Yes, you had your hands up for ages.
Five.
I know, but she's been waiting to ask a question, and I'm aware of terrible gender inequalities here.
My question is actually also about gender equality, and refers to the egalitarian outlook that you you cited Wolfgang Merkel's five different aspects.
Speak up.
And I was wondering, my question is about the distribution of care work, paid and unpaid work, and whether you think there should be an active role for a government to encourage the more equal distribution of unpaid work to enhance equal opportunities in employment.
Six, all right.
Well, I mean, I reckon six is enough for everybody, so I propose that we all pack up after I try to answer these questions. Well, there are actually five, if you forgive me, because there were two questions on inheritance tax, but they weren't exactly the same. The point that was made about inheritance tax, I think, is, or inheritance, is quite right. I mean, you know, some of the political philosophers and the social sciences argue that you should, like Emil Durkheim, famous sociologist, turn of the century, argued you should have zero inheritance. You should have 100% inheritance tax because everyone should start from a level playing field. But as the questioner said, this is not remotely politically feasible. And the reality is that some countries have moved in the opposite direction and have abolished inheritance tax altogether. And some Tories want to do that in this country. And it actually has quite a range of populist appeal. Now, I certainly don't think we should do that. I don't think we should leave inheritance tax alone. The IPPR, the organization that I mentioned, just produced an interesting document on inheritance tax in which they suggested a more progressive inheritance tax, raising taxes for those who leave a lot of money as opposed to the standard rate that they have, a single rate of taxation now. Well, that, you know, that's not a bad suggestion, although again, it will only raise, deference to one of the questioners, only raise, I think, about
couple of hundred million pounds a year, but it would be an instrument of, to some extent, increasing social justice. But would it be electorally a handicap to Labour? I feel it would. So it's a dicey area with no clear-cut resolution. I mean, in principle, we should have higher inheritance taxes. But in practice, political feasibility of it makes it difficult. There's also this thing about baby bonds. Well, I'm in favour of so-called asset-based redistribution, which is what baby bonds are one version of, whereby you don't just try to redistribute income, but you try to give people assets at core parts of their lives. And these assets will be given to, or will be given to, young people when they reach a certain age. And I think it's basically a sensible idea, although is it enough to make significant difference? That's the issue with it. Another question was about New Labour philosophy leaving the top alone. And the questioner made several points saying, should we tax more heavily the top 5%? Well, I don't think anyone has proposed that. There are too many people in that category. Labour's chances of re-election would zero down if you propose that. The proposal is the top 1% from the Lib Dems. I said not a lot of money. I didn't say not a lot of money. Absolute terms, I said relative to the total proportion of taxation yielded in this country, it's actually a trivial amount compared to the amount that the government spends. And I still think you can get a lot more from other sources in ways which will have a better social effect than attempting to raise such taxes, which I think again would create an air of electoral vulnerability for Labour, which wouldn't be worth the return that they get for it. One of the questions was about economic policy creating social justice. Well, I never said that. What I said was I endorsed New Labour's proposal or policies that you must have a stable economy, you must as far as possible have decent growth rates if you are going to do something long term about inequality. It's no good doing short term things about inequality. You must have sound finances. It doesn't guarantee social justice. You must have a whole range of schemes which you fund through your economic success in order to do so. So it doesn't create social justice in and of itself. The two interesting final questions, one about devolution of power. Well, devolution, I think, is pretty important for social justice, and there are really interesting findings of a study done around Europe in terms of local communities that had the power to raise income tax, or to raise taxes, sorry, certain categories of taxes, as compared to those who don't. And the level of voting in local communities where there wasn't the possibility of raising tax was much lower than the level of voting in local communities which did have tax-raising powers, suggesting that people will vote if they see it's important. Therefore, fiscal devolution is something which at least we should be thinking about. The Lib Dems been thinking about it more than Labour so far, but to me it is a sensible sort of platform of policy. Finally, the question about unpaid work, it's a crucial part of all of this. But as I would see it, Labour is attempting to increase levels of social justice around this area. It's not just, I think, unpaid work, it's the balance between work and life, and especially for women. And the Labour Party is proposing to introduce more universal platform of childcare, of more or less freely provided childcare, which the evidence shows is really, really important for overcoming social inheritance, really, really important for creating a more egalitarian society towards the bottom. And I think this is good policy. It's not the same as unpaid work, but it sort of cross-cuts the boundary because it's important for women to be able to reconcile part-time work with childcare and obligations in the family. It's important for male parents also to have time off to look after children. This is also being proposed in Labour Party policy. Unpaid work, well, a lot of our society depends upon the unpaid work of carers. We know it does. And it's a fundamental problem of inequality, actually, because many such people simply give of themselves to provide a social service and don't get much back for it.
There is, again, I'm afraid, no simple solution to that issue except for investment in services which will take over some of the activities of private carers where they're needed in nursing and other areas. And I think actually Labour, again, has pretty decent policies on that. So thanks to everyone for coming, thanks to some of you for staying, and thanks for such a proliferation of interesting questions.